Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 62 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast has a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful hostess, Aaron Palant. How you doing, Aaron?
All day, kitten thinks about murder. And according to you, I am Murder Kitten.
Yes, my wonderful hostess who happens to be Murder Kitten. Aaron doesn't always think about murder, but metaphorically, yeah, sometimes.
It's been a day, and it's been a day for everyone, but, you know, the day's winding down, hanging out, doing the podcast, it'll all be cool. So, I know everyone likes to contribute to the fiction that I am young, and I dearly appreciate that. However, it is official, I am now middle-aged because I now have hypertension. It's been diagnosed, and I am on blood pressure medication. So, yay!
Well, I mean, better that than you being a head-in-the-sand person. I have known lots of people of the, oh, yeah, no, I knew there was stuff wrong with me. I just didn't do anything about it.
Well, I mean, I'm a bit of a connoisseur of headaches because I've had them all my life. And I frequently get sinus headaches because Florida. But vascular headaches, and that's like in the blood vessels, for people who don't know what vascular means. I used to have them when I was young. Like, going through puberty, I would just have all sorts of different headaches, including migraines, and it was awful. And then I got out of puberty, and it evened out, and now it's mostly just weather-related. But I started getting these terrible vascular headaches, like, you know, the pounding in the temples and behind the eyes. It was just, this is unusual. And, you know, I'm kind of getting to that age. Let's check the old blood pressure. Holy crap, that's high. And so I scheduled an appointment. And just to give you an idea, when I went to see the doctor, and the nurse did the blood pressure, and it was like around noon. So I'd been up for a bit, and I'd had my coffee, but it wasn't like an absolute stressful thing. I don't remember the bottom number, which I guess is diastolic. I guess is like systolic over diastolic. Is that how that works?
Oh, shoot.
Come on, you've got the biology degree.
I know how to take the blood pressure. I know what it means.
Okay. I don't remember the bottom number, but the top number, which was sitting down, resting, kind of being sedentary, was 174.
Yeah, that's no bueno.
Yeah, that's like, you know, stage two hypertension right there. That's not good. Maybe the reason my blood pressure is so high is because I'm uptight and I think I'm at murder. We'll see. Maybe this will chill me out. Or maybe this will just allow me to plot more intricate forms of revenge without it taking a toll on my body. Either way, I win.
When I was a kid, my parents sent me to science camp. It was awesome. And one of the classes that I took was taught by an RN, and one of the things we learned was we learned how to tie sutures, and we dissected chicken legs, which, like, right from the grocery store. It was like the leg thigh quarters, and I just like, seriously, we're dissecting those? And then, oh yeah, no, actually, if you know what you're doing and you know what you're looking for, there's all sorts of cool stuff in there that you're totally ignoring as you're eating them. I had chicken legs for lunch. Ah, I love chicken legs. But one of the things they taught us was, yeah, how to take blood pressure. And I don't know how it ended up, but it seemed to be I was always the guy when somebody was going, all right, my turn. Hey, weird, you're not doing anything. Here, let me take your blood pressure. And so I think I got my blood pressure taken like 100 times in like 45 minutes. And just my hand was just all pins and needles at the end of it. I should have kept track of the numbers. It would have been hilarious to just see of just your veins are just all crushed. They're not filling back up with blood.
So I was Googling while you were telling your story. For people who don't know, the systolic, the top number, normal is 120 or below, and I was 174. Yeah, that's like, it's normal, elevated, high blood pressure, And then hypertensive crisis. I didn't quite get into hypertensive crisis, but it's like, yeah, that's really not good. So
also, how you take it is you put a blood pressure cuff on, if you're doing it the old-fashioned way with just a manual cuff and a stethoscope. And then you put the blood pressure cuff around the bicep, and then you place the stethoscope, or actually low on the bicep, and you place the stethoscope on, I don't know my veins, whatever that big blue vein that's in your arm that they give you IVs in, and put it there. And you first listen until you hear a heartbeat. And as soon as you have got the stethoscope positioned so you hear a heartbeat, you start pumping and you start pumping and you start pumping. And at some point in time, that blood pressure cuff is going to squeeze hard enough that you're not going to hear the heartbeat anymore. And that, and the pressure that you're at is the first number. And then you slowly release the cuff, and at some point, the heartbeat's going to come back. That's the second number.
So the answer to your question is, well, because I Googled elbow vein, and the technical term for that is the median cubital vein.
Ah, thank you.
Also known as the median basilic vein, and I'm not sure why.
I don't know. Vascular stuff, I don't know. I learned how to put catheters in carotid arteries and the vena cava. So that's the jugular vein. So yeah, that's what I know. I know the big ones that you don't want to get punctured.
Yeah, like them big, don't you? So we've had a couple of very trivial and clinical in some ways digressions. You'd think, leading into Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, that we'd continue that. But David isn't just a repository of firearms history and trivia. He's also a professional trainer. And in this segment, he tells us some select stories about memorable students.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. Today's segment, Training Tales. As I've mentioned previously, I'm employed by a local range and gun shop as, among other things, a firearms trainer. I teach private lessons, specialized classes, and the Tennessee permit class. In the time I've been teaching for this company, I've interacted with many students. Most were a pleasure to deal with, some less so. Regardless, here are some stories of training experiences. Sometimes everything just falls into place for a student. On one occasion, I had a cardiac surgeon and his girlfriend come in for a private lesson. The girlfriend had talked him into taking the training, as he had never touched a handgun before. We went through the usual classroom orientation of safety, operation, grip, stance, sights, etc., and then headed out to the range. They decided to try out the Smith & Wesson EZ 380, and she decided that he would go first. So I had him load the magazine with 5 rounds, load and make ready, assume the firing stance, and fire one shot. He hit about an inch above the zero on a standard IDPA target that I had run out to 5 yards. Very good for his first shot ever. So I told him, good, do that 4 more times. And he did. All 5 shots were overlapping. Exactly what you want from a surgeon. I now see him visiting the range regularly, and he always has a smile on his face, because shooting is fun. One of the courses offered at the store is a basic AR class where I talk about the history of the platform, go through a teardown, discuss the parts in operation, and then we go out to the range for some trigger time. In one of these classes, a student asked me to take a look at his new-built rifle because he'd been having function issues. When I tore it down, I noticed 2 things. One, there was barely any lubrication, which can cause problems, but 2, and more importantly, there was a bullet stuck in the end of the chamber. With some gentle persuasion, I was able to get the bullet out and then cleaned and lubricated his rifle. Once we were out on the range, the rifle functioned much better, but occasionally still had rounds that stuck in the chamber. It turned out that while the barrel was marked 5.56, the chamber was a little short for some NATO spec rounds, and they would stick. When he switched to 223 Remington cases, the problem went away. His accuracy, on the other hand, was excellent, all the way out to the maximum 25 yards. Not bad for a guy in his early 80s. Not all of these stories are funny or have a happy ending. I recently taught a handgun carry permit class, and one couple had just moved here from Florida. Specifically, from Parkland, Florida. Their daughter was a student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. She was not physically harmed during the incident, but Mom was psychologically traumatized, as you might expect. So they sat through the entire 6-hour classroom portion. Mom asked a number of questions, most of them fairly pertinent. They took and passed the written test. Their scores weren't great, but they passed. Then we headed out to the range for the shooting qualification. She was only able to fire about 4 rounds from a .22 pistol before she became too stressed out and had to leave the line, and in fact, the range. It was at this point that she chose to tell me that she had never touched a gun before in her life. If I had known this at the beginning of class, I would have advised her to take a private lesson or the basic handgun class first. Unfortunately, this was not mentioned during the icebreaker portion of class. Another example of why your instructor needs to know certain things. To end on a lighter note, there are also funny, yet safe, incidents. I was second instructor for the first low-light class offered at our store. In this class, range lights are turned off, and on the fire command, students bring their firearm up from low ready, illuminate the target with a handheld flashlight, and fire one or more shots according to the exercise. It's a lot of fun. At the end of class, the primary instructor decided to show the students how this exercise worked with a weapon-mounted light. So he got set up in the bay, and on the word, brought up his handgun and fired his first shot. At which point, his weapon light decided it wanted to play too, and launched itself downrange. It hit the ground and spun like a top. Every time it spun around and illuminated the target, he would fire another round. His groups were pretty bad, because along with the rest of us, he was laughing. By the way, the weapon light was none the worse for wear after we retrieved it from downrange. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Oh man, that was just the whole, like, how do you react to that? I mean, there's just, it's good. I laughed, I cried, it had a beat, you can dance to it. It was a beautiful segment.
When he was telling the story about the cardiac surgeon and he hit it like 1 inch above center, I was cringing in anticipation of David saying something like, "Congratulations, you got him in the heart." Oh, geez. And just being, everything being awkward. And I'm glad that didn't happen. I'm not a big fan of cringy stories. And so thank you, David, for making that not cringy.
Well, what I liked was, Chaz Murray, the unnamed trucker, always used to point out the fact that when you give a gun to a new shooter, that first shot just goes right in the X. And I actually find that, like, when I get in like a new gun, I always load just like one round into it. And then the point is I fire it off at the target, and then I go and find the brass and I look at the brass just to make sure that there's nothing that's going to be dangerous about this gun, as I go forward. And I always find that first shot is awesome. And then once I start thinking about it, that's when I screw myself. And so it was interesting to hear that he did the, first timers, they always nail the middle of the target for that first shot. It's all the subsequent shots that are just all over the map.
Well, that's the principle of Zen archery, where you're supposed to shoot without thinking. And therefore, I mean, there's the philosophy of the arrow knows the way and all that other stuff, but the general principle of you overthink things, and that is what is causing most of your mistakes. So if you can just achieve that state of not thinking where you're just shooting, then you will become an excellent shooter, archer, whatever in this case.
Yeah.
So I guess the point is that because new students don't know what to think, they accidentally slip into that Zen state for their first shot.
Yeah, they're just sitting there and waiting to see what'll happen, because they have no idea. And they're looking forward to the shot versus us as we get it. Gunpowder goes off, the bullet goes downrange and all that. I'm working on my trigger press. This is just like Jeff Cooper said.
Yes.
Oh, did I cut out?
It's just like Jeff Cooper said.
Yeah. No, just the, he always talked about the surprise break, and he's just got, there's, you can find videos on YouTube of Jeff Cooper just talking about trigger presses.
Oh, so you mean it's just like Jeff Cooper said. Do you not hear the difference?
well, I probably screwed it up. That was what I was, that's what was sounded in my head. I will listen back to it and go, oh boy, that sucked.
The story that I thought was funniest was that lowlight story, just because, oh, okay, I'm going to be all super tactical, and here's my gun with the light, and whoops, launch the light forward, spinning around. I mean, I probably would have just been embarrassed rather than trying to shoot it as the light spins. So, I mean, just the fact that he attempted it was actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
Rather than just, oh, gee, I messed up in front of my students, everyone's laughing at me, which is probably the route I would have taken.
Yep. Yeah, it was interesting that that David had that story about the low-light class, because when I met the egghead for the first time at my Independence Day party, the first thing he did was ask me where he could put his famous chicken salad. Oh, it was his mom's recipe. It was really good. The second was that he pulled out his flashlight and showed me the therm switchback ring on it and how it works. Now, what is a therm switchback? Well, I'll let Egghead explain it to us all.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the General Purpose Egghead. I'm going to take a little bit of a break from talking about the theremin this week to give you a bit of a gear review on something that I picked up recently. Maybe two somethings, depending on the time. So I recently took a handgun course, and in the course there was a very brief section of low-light shooting. It wasn't a whole lot of time. It was an indoor range, but they just gave us a couple magazines. And I had a flashlight, and I was able to work with it just fine. But somebody at that class had something that I thought was really interesting, and I decided I had to pick one up. The company name, it's spelled T-H-Y-R-M. I think it's pronounced Therm, so I'm going to go with that. If it's not Therm, then, well, whatever. I'm going to call it Therm in this segment. Serves them right for having an obscure name. So the company is Therm, and the product is the Switchback flashlight ring. Right now, they're on the Switchback 2.0, which is the one that I have. But there's also a Switchback, I think it might be called the Switchback Mini. It's a smaller one for pocket flashlights. So it's a really clever device. It's a ring that attaches to your flashlight and allows you to hold it in a special grip that is much more intuitive and usable for one-handed shooting. So to describe how it looks, imagine you're holding a flashlight in your fist, like up by your chin, and the flashlight is pointing away from you, right? So your index finger and thumb are towards you, and you're operating the tail cap. Now imagine that there's a ring that comes off of the flashlight and wraps around your index finger. So it helps you get a little better grip on the flashlight, maybe stops you from accidentally dropping it. But more importantly, what happens is, if you want to put a two-handed grip on a handgun, you can just flip the flashlight around, basically drop it from your fist, and then flip it around. And now that ring is on your index finger, and the tail cap of the flashlight is resting on your middle finger. And the flashlight is pointing forwards if you have your palm facing towards you. So then if you put a two-handed grip on a handgun, you now have a flashlight that's pointing almost like an under-muzzle mounted flashlight, but it's just a regular flashlight that you're holding in your hand. So now how do you activate it? Well, this ring has got a little kind of triangle-shaped nub on top that you can push down on with your thumb if you have it in the two thumbs forward standard semi-auto grip. And when you do that, it pushes the flashlight against your ring finger, and you can activate the tail switch of the flashlight. It sounds a little awkward, but it's actually really intuitive in practice. I saw the guy operate it at the class, and I said, hey, can I borrow that for a second? And I held it, and I tried it, and without even any kind of practice or training, I was able to easily use both the momentary function and the click to lock on and click to lock off function. So I, of course, had to have one. The biggest problem I had was finding a flashlight that fit them. They publish a fit guide saying it will fit these flashlights or won't fit those flashlights, but the problem is a lot of these flashlights, they're kind of named the similar. I actually had an issue where there's the Streamlight Polytac series, and then there's the Streamlight Polytac X. I bought the X. It doesn't fit the X. It fits everything else in the Streamlight Polytac series. So if you're going to get one of these, spend some time and really make sure with that guide that it actually fits that particular flashlight, because I just spent $60 on a flashlight that I didn't really want, which kind of sucks. I found one that it fits and I love it. It's got a heavy duty pocket clip on it. It's pretty stout. It's not going to break off. And the other thing they thought about that I wouldn't have thought about myself is that this flashlight ring is attached around your index finger, right? And if you're in a scuffle with somebody and they grab your flashlight and try and wrench it out of your hand, you might run the risk of breaking your finger, right? Because he's going to wrench on it and that ring is going to twist your finger in a very uncomfortable way. Well, the Switchback 2.0, the flashlight ring is breakaway. So if you apply a lot of force to it, the one of the areas where the ring meets the flashlight will just pop out. And it's resettable. It's got a sort of a latch. It's a little round protrusion that sits in a little round recess in the flashlight, and it just snaps into place. So if you pop it off, you can just click it right back in. So they already thought of something that, you know, could have been a problem with their device, could have been a drawback, and they worked around it. The only drawback I still see is that it's a little bit harder to fit in a pocket now. If you use the pocket clip, it's fine, but it does make your flashlight a little bulkier. There's really no way of getting around that. But I really like it for two-handed shooting with a flashlight, and it's even better than a weapon-mounted light, in my opinion. It's not quite as stable as a weapon-mounted light, obviously, and you still don't get quite as good of a grip as just full two-handed shooting grip, because your index finger and your middle finger are a little bit occupied. But it's better in the sense that one of the controversies around weapon-mounted lights is, well, if I have a weapon-mounted light, I might want to light something up, but not necessarily point a gun at it, right? Well, if you've got the Switchback, it's not really a problem. Sorry about that click, by the way. I'm fiddling with it and flipping it around, and I banged my microphone. So if you have the Switchback, that's not really a problem, because you've got the flashlight held in the regular shooting grip, and if you want to illuminate something off to your left or right, you just take your left hand off of the gun with the flashlight and illuminate that thing while keeping your gun pointed in a safe direction. So I really liked that feature about it. It just seems really well thought out. It solves a problem that people have been trying to solve for a while. There's a bunch of different techniques for using a flashlight. There's Harry's, there's Chapman, there's the FBI neck index, and then there's the FBI where you stick your hand way out to the side. I really like this solution to it, so I thought I'd pass it along. So originally here, I was going to also review the flashlight that I bought to go with it, the Nightcore P12, but I ended up feeling like it was a little bit rushed. I was trying to cram too much information into too short of a space. So I'd like to talk about one of the other drawbacks I found with the Switchback 2.0, and that is trying to find a flashlight to fit it. There was actually quite a process trying to figure out what I wanted to get with it, and my main complaint is that all the flashlights that fit the Switchback 2.0 are huge. They're like full-size tactical lights, right? I carry on a daily basis a Streamlight ProTac 1L1AA. I like the fact that it runs on AA batteries, but I can also put a CR123 in it if I really want to push some lumens. It's bright, but not too bright. It lasts a while, and it's tiny. It's just this little thing. I really appreciate the size of it. It's very convenient. And it's also really easy to feed. There's nowhere in the world where you're not going to be able to find AA batteries. Now, unfortunately, neither the Switchback 2.0 or the Switchback S Backup, which is the smaller version designed to fit smaller flashlights, fit that light. So I had to go shopping for something else. Now, the Backup S fits a number of very small flashlights from Surefire, but that's about it, and each one of those flashlights is both A, very expensive, and B, uses expensive non-rechargeable CR123 batteries. I actually tried to get rechargeable CR123s, and they sell them, but the capacity is just terrible on them. They feel like they go dead right away, especially in a high-drain flashlight. So that wasn't really an option. And then when I got into the full-size tactical flashlights, each one of these things seems to want to put out like 600 or 700 lumens all the time without a really easy-to-access low-light setting. And a lot of them use non-rechargeable lights as well. There's only a couple of them that they've designed to use rechargeables. And I really wanted a light that I didn't really have to feel any sort of pain when I'm using it, because I didn't have to worry about having to run up and pick another bucket full of $2 a piece batteries to power it. I ended up with the Nightcore P12, and it does low power outputs that you can set and remember so that when you turn it on, it's less than a bajillion lumens, uses a rechargeable battery, and it fits the Switchback 2.0. But it's still larger than I'd really like to carry on an EDC, right? This is the kind of flashlight that I'm going to carry when I'm in the mood to carry a full-size double-stack gun and an extra magazine and my cool flashlight and maybe, like, strap on a tourniquet somewhere. Like, if I feel like going full tack out, I'll carry this flashlight. But most of the time, it's going to end up as a bedside gun because the light is just a little bit too big to be an EDC light. So anyone from Therm, if you are listening, please make one of these rings that fits the ProTac 1L 1AA. It's a tiny little flashlight, I carry it all the time, it's reasonably bright, and it's cheap to feed. And it's the kind of flashlight that, if I had a ring on it, I would actually have it on me all the time. And Streamlight, if you're listening, the 1L 1AA is the Goldilocks flashlight. Like, I love it. More lights like that, please. So that's it for this week, guys. Next week, I will be doing a more detailed review of the Nightcore P12, which is the flashlight that I got to fit this ring. It's a kind of a neat little light. It's got some neat features that I'd like to talk about. So see you next week. Stay safe. Be smart.
So weird. It's funny. And okay, readers, bear with me as I geek out here. So even though Egghead pronounced it Therm, and that's how it was spelled, weird, for reasons, he wrote it down as Therm, T-H-R-Y-M. And when I saw this, before I listened to the segment, I went, Therm, oh boy, because I know my mythology, and I know D&D, and I know that Therm was king of the frost giants in Norse mythology. So clearly there's going to be some sort of really cool Norse thing in here, and you know what? Surtur was king of the fire giants. And so I bet that these people, in addition to their Therm ring, that they're going to make like a awesome all the lumens flashlight called Surtur. And you know, it'll be, you know, gigantic and frost giant and fire giant. It'll be so cool. And then I listen to it and it's like, Therm. Oh, okay then.
So in other news, Aaron and I are starting a flashlight company. All about the frost giants and the fire giants. We could even have a flashlight called the Chubby Thor.
So there was one flashlight I saw however many years ago when I went to Big Three, and I do not remember the name of it, but when I say all the lumens, this one had all the lumens because, okay, there was a handle that mounted to the back, and I swear I'm not making this up, it looked like a medieval mace. And it was overbuilt such that I bet you could swing it like a mace and take someone's head off, or at least stove it in, and the thing would still go. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember what it was called. I just remember it was massive, and it weighed a lot. And it was some sort of ridiculous, like, $400 flashlight. It was just, oh my God.
Because God knows you need a flashlight that can piss off the people on the ISS.
Exactly. And so, you know, if we're going to do a flashlight company modeled after Norse giants, well, that's got to be our baseline, man.
Oh, this has gotten rather silly, Aaron.
Yeah, well, you know.
Shall we talk about something a little more serious?
So, weird, last week when you interviewed Logan Medish, I confessed rather ashamedly that I had never heard of John Pederson. And then I listened to this segment where you and he discussed the Pederson device of World War One, and I went, oh, no, I have heard of this. I know exactly what you're talking about. But because I read it, I didn't know he was pronounced Pederson. I read it more as Peterson, and Peterson became Peterson. So in my mind, I thought it was the Peterson device. Mm-hmm. And so now I hope I can redeem myself by going, yes, I did actually know something about this man. Now, for our listeners who have no clue what I'm talking about, well, Logan is here to explain to you in great detail what the Peterson device was and how it could have changed history.
So we were talking previously about the history of John Peterson and his firearms design, one of the more lesser known firearms greats in American history. And so joining me again is Logan Medish of High Caliber History. How you doing, Logan?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing great. So where do we leave off?
So we left off after having talked about some of the early pump guns that John Peterson created, and we went through his guns that were competing with the M1 rifle, and we talked about his handgun designs, but we definitely left off some of his most influential and well-known pieces, and we figured we would dedicate a new segment to those guns. So in World War I, the M1903 and the M1917 30-06 bolt-action rifles are the gun that most of the American doughboys are fielding. And of course, as the war slogs on year after year after year, it's hard to gain ground because they're stuck in the trenches and they need to find a way to break through no man's land and really go on the offensive. And so John Peterson begins in 1915 designing what is going to become a secret weapon for our doughboys, and he's getting things squared away between 1915 and 1917, and eventually he creates something that is supposed to be an absolute game changer and is designed to be put into use in the spring offensive in 1919, which of course doesn't ever end up happening because the armistice is signed at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, and the war is over. But what he creates is something really, really remarkable and unusual. It's what is very inventively named the Peterson device. And this is a unit that takes the place of the bolt in a bolt-action rifle. And so you slide the bolt out of the 1903, and you slide the Peterson device into its space, and then attach a 40-round magazine with a 30 caliber pistol cartridge in it. And that takes your bolt action rifle and transforms it into a semi-automatic. And the goal behind this was to give the American forces something that they could come out of the trenches and make their way through no man's land and with adequate firepower, faster firepower, that they could keep moving forward and go on and really have an impact in moving the lines during World War I's stalemated trench warfare. It's a really fascinating concept and a really, really neat design. But again, if you listened to our previous segment, one of the things that I said over and over and over again was that it was too little too late. And the Peterson device never sees combat. They made about 65,000 of them. So out of the 65,000 that were made, most of them ended up being destroyed because the government didn't want to pay to store stuff that they were never going to use. So consequently, they're incredibly rare. Somewhere between 70 and 100 of them managed to survive the destruction. And they're an incredibly cool piece of what should have been World War I history. But of course, it never comes to fruition. And like many things in John Peterson's career, it just doesn't quite make it over the top, and it kind of stalls out there. But that doesn't change the fact that he was a fantastic designer, and it was a fantastic, innovative piece that I really do think could have turned the tide of the war had it slogged on into a spring offensive in 1919. Of course, we were fortunate enough that it didn't.
So I want to get into a little bit of technical details on this device, just because I think unless someone's literally like looked at articles or seen stuff written about this device, they might not fully understand what we're talking about. So Now, I believe for a Springfield 1903 to accept this, it needed to have an ejection port cut into the receiver. Is that correct?
That's correct. They ended up creating what was known as the M1903 Mark I, and it had a little bit of a bump out in the stock on the left-hand side, as well as a slot in the receiver on the left-hand side, acting as the ejection port.
And, I mean, you referred to it... Was it called 30 caliber pistol? What was the cartridge designation?
Yeah, it was 30 caliber pistol, and it was kind of, the way I understand it, it was kind of designated as that in order to confuse anyone who might have gotten wind of the design and what was coming. They would think it was just a new handgun design that the military was going to be fielding, not a new long gun conversion.
Yeah. And what were the technical specs on that cartridge? So really it was a pistol cartridge.
It was. It absolutely was a pistol cartridge, very similar to what ends up becoming the 7.65 pistol cartridge. So it's certainly not the most potent thing out there, but that really wasn't the point. The point was, piece through superior firepower in terms of numbers, and having a 40 round stick mag sticking out of the side there. That was really what it was all about. It was about being able to fire much more rapidly, and much more efficiently, and having more rounds at your disposal than you would have had working with that bolt action rifle if it were still in 30-06. And you can switch back and forth. That's still the beauty of it, is that, you know, if you run out of these 30 caliber pistol cartridges, just pull the Pedersen device out, slide your standard bolt back in, and load some 30-06, and you're back in business. So it was really innovative that it didn't require any permanent alteration of the gun in order to use it. That was a really cool feature of it, especially because the Pedersen device was a little finicky, and it was not something that was terribly user-friendly to try to repair in the field. I've had the pleasure or displeasure, depending on how you look at it, to disassemble one of these pieces because we were needing to get some internal measurements taken off of it, and it came apart easy enough, but trying to put it back together, I found myself in need of a third hand that I simply don't have. And I actually ended up, after about an hour, I was frustrated enough that I had to grab a colleague to come over and hold on to part of it so that I could get the pieces back together, because it's just not possible with two hands. And I can't imagine trying to do it in the trenches in World War I while you're being shelled. That's just not feasible. If it were me, I would be like, to hell with it, throw it to the side, pop the regular bolt back in, and just run 30-06.
Yeah. And again, another thing to think about is that, I mean, at the time, it's a pistol caliber carabine. It's really a pistol caliber rifle, because you can't call the 1903 a carbine in any sense of the word.
Right.
But essentially, it turned it into a rifle that's shooting a pistol caliber. So you're not quite up to the firepower of a submachine gun. Though, again, at the time, the submachine gun was the Thompson. And so when you realize what a big, heavy gun that is, and how small and light this Pedersen device was, it really was amazing that you could do kind of a quick swap.
Yes, absolutely. And it doesn't require any new training. You know, you've got guys that already know how to use the O3, and they know how to remove the bolt, you know, and that's really all it takes. If you can field strip and remove a bolt and slide this thing back in, they know how to insert a magazine because they've worked with the 1911 pistols. It just was designed to be really user friendly and require no extra training. So it was supposed to be an incredibly convenient thing for our guys and just give them a tremendous boost in firepower in terms of numbers of rounds, not necessarily firepower in terms of the power of the cartridge.
Yeah, that's one of those things, just like the FP Liberator 45, that is just one of those things that, oh man, I mean, I'm glad we never ended up using it because war is awful, but at the same time, it seems like such a great innovation that I really would have loved to have seen how well it would have worked in that time frame.
Yeah, it really would have been fascinating to see how the spring offensive would have played out. You know, would it have dragged on into the summer and into the fall? And we don't know. But I would like to think that it probably would have been done by the summer of 1919. But again, you know, maybe that's just hopeful Yanks perspective on things, looking back at the war. Who knows? The soldiers might have found, again, like I did, that they're a little finicky and hard to service in the field, and that maybe they wouldn't have been as effective as we had hoped they would be. But again, that's just one of those what-ifs, one of those many what-ifs of history that we'll simply never know about. But nonetheless, it's a really cool design that he came up with to fix a problem. And like you'd said, you know, thank God we didn't end up needing to use this design, because it ended up saving countless lives because the war ended up over before it was needed.
So we've kind of jumped around a little bit in history, talking about his earlier works, and we were just talking about World War One. Though last time we were talking about the pre-World War II trials with the M1 Garand versus the Pedersen rifle. So what happens during and after World War II for John Pedersen?
So the really interesting thing with Pedersen during World War II is, of course, there are tons of arms designs being produced by tons of different contracts and trying to churn out the amount of guns that the Allied forces need. And it's the same thing with the M1 carbine. And so Pedersen teams up with the Irwin family. I believe they're based out of Michigan. And he teams up with them. They've got the money. He's got the government contacts. And they secure a contract to make the M1 carbine, a contract to make 100,000 of them. But once again, that constant nagging too little too late jumps in there in Pedersen's career, and there are issues with production, and they only ended up making about 3,500 of them, making it the rarest of the M1 carbine out there. And then the rest of the contract ended up being given to Saginaw. And so they finished out the other 90-some thousand guns that Irwin Pedersen never got around to. So if you happen to find an Irwin Pedersen carbine at a decent price, pick it up, because it'll definitely be worth having. Unfortunately for Pedersen, military contracts are really not his thing. He just seems to be thwarted at every turn trying to get these squared away. So he ends up going back to the civilian market, which does really well for him. He ends up going back to Remington, and they make the Model 10 shotgun. That's a pump action shotgun. They make about 275,000 of those. And then with some improvements to this design, we end up coming back to John Moses Browning again in the Remington Model 17 shotgun, which was a Browning design that Pedersen ended up working on as well, and making some different alterations to the design to really put together and put to market a top notch high quality shotgun. And that's what they get with the Model 17. But then things transition again, and we get a design that is really well known, and that people know even today because it's still in production, what goes on to become the Ithaca Model 37, which is just a fantastic shotgun. And knowing the history that it's got two of the greats involved in the design, John Browning and John Pedersen, it really becomes easy to understand why it's been such a successful shotgun throughout history. And so that's kind of Pedersen's career in a nutshell. He is a fantastic designer. He is lauded by John Moses Browning, calls him the greatest gun designer in the world. But Pedersen seems to be thwarted at a lot of turns, and the military contracts are just never there for him, whether it's with his pistol for World War One, his rifles with World War Two, his carbines in World War Two. Just doesn't work out for him. But thank God the civilian market and Remington does incredibly well by him. And so even though he's not terribly well known, he is definitely up there as one of the most influential firearms designers of the 20th century, and he really doesn't get his due.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about that. You said talk about anything, and I said, geez, there really does need to be more talk on John Pederson, because he's one of those, if you start digging through any historical stuff on firearms, it seems like, especially in American history, his name comes up almost as much as John Moses Browning, but again, almost always in Browning's shadow or something that competed against something else. And that is to say something about constantly being in second place is not really a bad place to be. So,
yeah, second place is not bad if the person who's directly in front of you is Browning, you know?
Exactly. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Logan Medish of High Caliber History. Really appreciated having you on, and hopefully we'll hear from you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, and by the way, I made a really dumb mistake in that interview, is I somehow thought that the Thompson submachine gun was being issued at World War One. Yeah, totally wrong on that. Like, that makes a big difference. So that's one of those ones of listening back to it. Oh man, can I cut that out? No, I can't. Okay. So all right, I'm just gonna draw attention to you. Weird Beard made a boo-boo. I hope you caught it.
You know, I am not the one to do this, because I don't have, I feel the level of scholarship, but it would be a really interesting alternate history, science fiction, well, science fiction in the regard that it's alternate history.
Yeah, I count that as science fiction.
Okay. You know, to tell a story about World War One where either the war continued into 1919, or maybe John Pederson invented the device earlier, and so all of our soldiers were equipped with semi-automatic rifles.
Yeah, that, I mean, just again, we said it there, is so good that the war ended when it did, but at the same time, I would have loved to have seen how that worked. Like, it's one of those, that and the FP45 Liberator, the little 45 caliber smooth bore gun that they just would drop into, or they were supposed to drop into France and possibly some of the islands in the Pacific, so that just the insurgents there could just start causing mayhem. And it seems like such a great idea, and the fact that it never got used, I just always makes me wonder, but would it have worked?
Yeah, it's a really interesting bit of orphaned technology, and there are all these tech trees, if you will, if you're a gamer, that just sort of, they never developed. They died in their crib. Just as an interesting aside here, have you ever heard of, and I may be butchering the pronunciation, ekranoplans or ekranoplanes?
I don't know if I have. I mean, I might have heard of the concept, so.
So this is a specific, highly specialized form of technology that the Russians use. So the Black Sea in Russia is an inland sea. It's quite large. It doesn't connect to other bodies of water. They had to find a way to get troops across it. And so they invented the Ekranoplan, which is a ground effect vehicle. It is quite literally a plane. It's a seaplane, but it flies over the water at a really, really low height, like just about a couple of feet. Mm-hmm. And it uses the ground effect, where I don't know, I'm not an engineer here, but it's just the interaction with, you know, the thrust and the wings and the surface of the water. And the entire idea was that it's basically, it's like, it's more so than hydrofoils. Mm-hmm. And it was just a very fast way to get troops and jeeps and maybe even tanks just across this inland sea. And that's all it did. They never used it anywhere else. And when the Cold War ended, they were scrapped. And they are fascinating, and they look, okay, they look Russian. They're the big Goonie bird with the big outboard jet engines, and you look at it and it's like, it looks like a plane but not, and it's just bizarre, and it's just this weird little tree of orphan technology that never went anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, but and also at the same time, though, you gotta wonder, if it had other uses, we probably would see it again. It's kind of like, I remember hearing Ian, I can't remember which one of his channels he was on, but it was either Forgotten Weapons or In Range TV. And they were talking about like reproductions of classic guns. And they're essentially kind of saying like, just it doesn't work, because as a general rule, if there's a classic gun that works, they're still making it. Smith & Wesson's still making revolvers. Everybody and their mother is still making a single action army. You can get break action shotguns and, you know, bolt action rifles, but then some of the stuff that you're like, oh man, I, you know, wouldn't that be great? Well, either no, it wouldn't really be as great as you thought, or there's other stuff that does that better. And oh my goodness, that is, I'd heard about it. I don't think I'd ever seen one. It is a very much a flying boat.
Yeah. And it's like I said, I mean, when it's got 8 engines, 4 to a side, it looks so very Russian. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it didn't go anywhere is because the ground effect requires a level surface. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm looking here, it's the aerodynamic interaction between wings and that level surface. And so the Black Sea being inland, it didn't have a whole lot of waves. It was relatively stable. You know, you get it out on the open ocean with all the waves and all the wind and the storms, it wouldn't work.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not really suitable for crossing oceans, but for a big inland sea like this. And so that's why it never went anywhere. It's a cool idea that just this one little niche and then never again.
It's probably also only good for a very narrow window of distances. It's probably for a short distance. No, you're probably better off using a boat, and a distance too much longer than what they used it for, you're probably better off climbing up high into the air where the drag is so much lower, and you'll save fuel and just get rid of a whole lot of other problems. So it's probably also got a very, very narrow operating window. That's probably the width of the Black Sea.
Pretty much. But yeah, it occupies that little niche along with like the autogyro and the ornithopter and things like that.
Well, the ornithopter was just something that wasn't official, but autogyros, I mean, they're still around. As a matter of fact, I was hanging out at my uncle's place this weekend. He lives on a lake and it was super hot, so we just went out and jumped in the lake, and I keep trying to talk him into, he just wants something that he can fly over the lake, and I keep telling him, and he's a metal worker, and I mean, he was a machinist before he retired, and I'm just like, he is currently building a car, and my dad was kind of joking on the fact that, man, he's been working on that car for years, and then I was looking at it and going, yeah, no, he is building a car. He's not putting a kit together. Like, he is actually fabricating all of the pieces, and he's doing it in his spare time just for fun. So yeah, no, it's gonna take a while. And I was just like, oh yeah, no, you totally need to build a gyrocopter because they're cool. He's like, no, it's gonna kill me. I'm like, no, be cool. They're so cool, especially like the really, really like home-built ones where like the guy's like, I've seen guy like taxiing down the runway and he's reaching up with his gloved hand and spinning the rotor just to get it going by hand. Love it. And Mad Max.
Okay, I have to issue a correction. I am so sorry. It is not the Black Sea. It is the Caspian Sea. Okay. Because the Black Sea does connect via like the Straits of Istanbul to the Mediterranean, but the Caspian Sea is completely locked. So I want to admit my boo-boo and get it out of the way now before someone angrily writes in, no, it's not the Black Sea, it's the Caspian.
Oh, I'm going to dogpile on that person. Oh, Erin confused her inland Russian seas. How could she possibly do that? Okay, yes, I can understand if you're a peasant from the steppes of Kazakhstan. All right, maybe that's a little ignorant.
We are both getting punchy. Yeah. So, you know what? I think it's time again for another house dicking.
Yes. So, full disclosure, as of 4 p.m. this afternoon, we did not have our prerequisite 3 segments. And I was like going, are we going to do the show? What are we going to do? What are our solutions here? And now we got 4. So, we've had some people that have pulled in and made this work. And Steve just did a thing I think of beauty, is he just pulled out his phone and he gave us a wonderful snapshot of what a Monday afternoon for the ACP house dick looks like.
Good afternoon and good evening. This is another episode of Tales from the Trunk. This is your friendly segment host and contributor, the Trunk Monkey, Steve. I'm actually recording live from a Monday surveillance. It is July 22nd. I was beaten over the head by Weird and Aaron to contribute a segment, because admittedly, the free ice cream machine on my end has been well and severely busted. I'm currently just into hour 8, and it's likely to go to 16 or more. I'm fixing the mistake, one of the rather frequent mistakes of the rookie today. The last time I told you a story about the rookie, he went fishing for a lost GPS device. Matter of fact, it was just down the road. But he screwed up a bluff on this particular case and almost got us burned. But of course, if you want something done right, you gotta do it yourself. So I took it upon myself to not bill the claimant or bill the client, the rookie's screw up. And I'm out here working my magic. The case is rather easy to handle. He's predictable. His business and his home are both nearby. And we have Dearborn PD showing up? Oh, this might be interesting. Well, are they going to go after a speeder? It is the tactical unit. Oh, boy. I wonder what's going on. Oh, yes, what? I'm parked in the Warrendale neighborhood of Detroit / Dearborn. The city limits are really kind of blurred here. And it makes for an interesting neighborhood. You have Islamic and Christian bakeries. You have madrasas. You have check cashing joints. You have fruit and grocery markets where everything is in Arabic. So picture if Beirut and Detroit had a baby. But it looks like maybe the tactical squad is... they're just stopping in at the liquor store? I haven't noticed anything. Well, maybe they bought themselves a soda. So, yeah. Nice little distraction there. Not exactly sure what they're up to. But as it stands, temperature is now probably about 90 degrees and it's cloudy. And I got the windows down. So if somebody accosts me and you hear a gunshot, send help. You can only run the AC in your vehicle for so long because the recirculated air eventually is no longer cold. And it's just extra wear and tear on your vehicle. And admittedly, I don't fit in this particular neighborhood one way or the other, so I'll probably wind up going across the street getting some shawarma for dinner later tonight. I expect to be out here well past the witching hour because my target is at his place of business where he claims he can't be working and everything else, and their open hours on Monday appear to be 12:30 to midnight. And of course, you know, I started my day bright and early at like 7 a.m. Of course, that meant my happy ass was up at like 5:30 just to get myself going for the day. Other than that, you know, business is moving right along. Expansion plans are in the works. And an actual brick-and-mortar office for your friendly neighborhood ninja that is not, you know, the decades-long home office kind of gig, is actually nearing fruition. So I'll actually have a place for clients to come visit and possibly shenanigans to ensue so I can actually take it out of my home office and, you know, be official. You know, I've passed that hump, you know, where all new, you know, small businesses fail within 5 years. I've been at it officially on my own since 2013. Matter of fact, I just sent in my license renewal earlier this month for the second time. Licensing up here in Michigan is good for 3 years a pop, $200. Of course, you know, the licensing scenario is interesting here in the state of Michigan. It's $750 to start and $300 at your renewal. Of course, my errors and omissions and, you know, general liability isn't that expensive. It's a couple bucks a month for $1 million of coverage and more. And because I carry a firearm and some of my other guys do, you know, I have a rider on that. So as long as they're legit with their CPL, I should be okay. But yeah, you know, I'll try and kick the free ice cream machine. So if you listeners have ideas or requests for stories, I did get bugged by a guy who looked like a Deliverance banjo guy yesterday. I mentioned that on my Facebook wall. I'll probably bring that up on the Facebook page itself for ACP. But yeah, I'm going to try and add more free ice cream to the mix here in the coming weeks. But yeah, this is your friendly neighborhood sweaty ninja signing out. You guys have a good one and stay out of trouble. And as always, stay ninja.
You are so easily entertained.
I was so excited when I heard like the cops are rolling up. I'm like, is something going down? And you could hear Steve getting interested, going, oh, what's going on here?
Oh, it's the tactical team.
Yeah, exactly. It's the and then it's just like, oh, they're at the liquor store. Be hilarious if they just came out with sacks and sacks of beers.
But yeah, I think I mentioned this on, I don't know if it was a mag dump or a round table or what, because I'm loofy, but when you come down to Phoenix for GRPC, I know another private investigator who's going to be there, and you can hang out with him, and he likes whiskey and dive bars, and, you know, I think you will just be starstruck and, you know, taking notes and asking him all sorts of questions, and you're gonna basically be all, oh, senpai, tell me more about private investigation.
Look, I knew GRPC and AmCon was going to be fun, but the level of fun that now you're promising me, that this is good. So thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/sodacalibrspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
I don't know why I hate doing this, but I hate doing it. Blah, 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 blah. You know who I am. You know where to find me. I'm everywhere. I'm awesome. Come listen to me. Read my stuff.
We'll just put all of Aaron in the show notes.
They've heard it by this point. I mean, I hear your Weird World. That's weerdworld.com. I hear that in my dreams. So, you know.
So I'm the man of Aaron's dreams. You heard it first. Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He wants to start a flashlight company based on Nordic giants, and I'm a little Thor. Or whatever you want to call this is so sorted. I'm Bill Cosby now. And so is our podcast. Good night, everybody. Woo!
And I think on that note, I should set you off to bed.